Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I am Yu Yunzhan, host of our monthly podcast, Zhonghua Mundus, that brings you recent updates about Chinese economy. Today, we would like to explore China's engagement in Africa. As usual, I am with our senior fellow, Alicia Garcia Herrero. Hi, Alicia. Thank you for joining us from your holiday. How are you?
All fine. Thank you, Yu Yun.
We are also glad to have with us today Eric Olander, veteran journalist and the co-founder of the China Global South Project, an independent, nonpartisan media initiative dedicated to exploring every facet of China's engagement in Africa, Asia, and across the developing world. He's joining us from Washington, D.C. today, although he's usually based in Ho Chi Minh City. Eric, welcome to The Sound of Economics.
Yuan, it's great to be here and so nice to speak with Alicia again. I'm really looking forward to our discussion today.
Likewise. China's economic engagement in Africa is a multifaceted and strategically significant relationship that has evolved rapidly over the past few decades. This engagement spans a wide range of sectors, including infrastructure, natural resources, technology, and trade, and is driven by a combination of economic, geopolitical, and developmental interests. Eric, could you walk us through the historical context of this relationship and maybe highlight a few major projects?
Yeah, it's a great place for us to start because there's different eras of China's engagement in Africa. So there's the 1960s when Mao was sponsoring kind of ideological liberation, anti-colonial movements. Let's kind of put that aside for now and focus more on the modern era and starting really around the early aughts in 2000, 2003 and 4. And this was a time when President Hu Jintao was looking around the world because the Chinese economy was growing. He needed to provide expansion opportunities for Chinese companies. Excess capacity was building up domestically. So they started to look around the world. And naturally, the first place they looked is where the money is. So they looked at the G7 countries, Japan, Europe, South Korea, and the United States. But the barriers to entry were very high, regulatory barriers. Chinese companies at that time weren't that sophisticated. And so they said, you know what, we're not going to be able to do that. They then looked at the Americas, Latin America, Central America, but at that time, that was far away, their language differences, and also they were afraid of antagonizing the United States, who still very much, even to this day, sees the Western Hemisphere as within their sphere of influence, and it wasn't their objective back then to be able to poke the United States. And then Asia was already deeply engaged, so they didn't need to look to Asia, and there was Africa. You know, the United States and Europe took their eye out off the ball after the end of the Cold War, and they kind of relegated Africa to an afterthought. It was the place where we are the world, let's save the children, and it was a place of war and famine, but it was not a place of opportunity or strategic importance to the West. And the Chinese came in, they said, you know, listen, you have something that we need. We're capital rich, resource poor. You're capital poor, resource rich. This feels like it's going to work. And the Africans were very receptive to the Chinese engagement because they wanted to break the dependencies on Europe and the United States. And let's not forget, during most of the Cold War, Africa was a major battleground. And so they were exhausted and tired of the relationship that they had with the West. And the Chinese came in and they said, listen, we don't do aid, we don't do charity. And African government said, that's exactly what we want to break away from. We want to do business. We have a young, dynamic, growing population. We want to grow. And so that's where it started. And this boom just took off for about 20, 25 years. Now, the first phase, China looked to Africa for minerals, oil, timber. Back in 2008, China sourced 30% of its oil from three African countries, the Republic of Congo, Sudan, and Angola. But over time, Africa's economic importance to China has diminished considerably, all the way to the point today where China sources about 8% of its oil from Africa. Most of the mineral, timber, and oil that it gets from Africa, it can now get anywhere along the Belt and Road. So we've seen a transition from looking to Africa for economic importance to now looking to Africa for political importance. And that's a shift that's been taking place over 25 years. Just one last point. Total trade between China and Africa last year was $282 billion. That is the largest trading relationship that Africa has with any country, not continent, country. It trades more with Europe than any other continent. But when you look at China's total global trade balance, $282 billion is nothing. And so it's about 3 to 4%. So economically, you can see if Africa disappeared tomorrow from China's trade balance, China wouldn't know about it, other than the cobalt, coltan, and some of the strategic resources in the DRC, most everything else it can get from other countries.
Thank you very much, Eric, for this wonderful introduction. Alicia, could you give us an assessment of the economic impact of these engagements, as Eric has just pointed out?
Well, first of all, I fully agree with Eric. Eric, so happy to have this discussion. It's been a while. So first of all, you're so welcome. And I'm sure our listeners are going to love this episode. But beyond saying that, I quite agree that the relative importance is by no means comparable. Yeah, I mean, China is so important for Africa and not necessarily the other way around. But, you know, interestingly, and this is really the law of the big numbers, maybe I should say, is that sometimes you don't know which numbers are bigger when you look at them. Let me explain what I mean. Europe actually is a much bigger trading partner for Africa overall than China. And very few people know this. And this is because the large number story is about the newcomer. I mean, China is the newcomer, is the opportunity, is that idea of everything can be multiplied the year after. But it is not multiplied. In fact, if you look at the numbers, China is still on the export side of things for Africa, 12% below the EU. So the EU is still a bigger market for Africa. But most importantly, going back to the relative relevance, so basically, when you look at the import side, China becomes much more relevant. So Africa imports much more from China than Europe. And that means that Africa has a huge trade deficit with China. It's ironic because, you know, all of these commodities that China needs, yeah, while it has a big surplus with Europe. So to put that in numbers, it's $40 billion deficit, bilateral trade deficit with China, $60 billion bilateral trade surplus with Europe. So what I'm trying to say is that when you read the news, it seems Europe does not exist in Africa somehow, that it used to, but it's no longer there. But when you actually look at the numbers, it is there. And trade is much more balanced, or at least not balanced, in an Africa's favor, if you want, because they do have a trade surplus with Europe. And still, it would look as if it doesn't exist. So for me, this is surprising, is it? Because our narrative, we Europeans, is so bad. It's all about anti-colonialism. Is it because what we do is not relevant? Is it? But, you know, for me, this is a big question mark, if you think about it, because those numbers should be read differently in the region. And I don't think that's the case. So I just wanted to relaunch this to you to see how you feel about it.
Yeah, so I think a couple of different things. One is I think we have to be careful talking about Africa. I mean, this is 54 countries. And when we look at China's trade relationship with Africa, it's highly distorted. And what I mean by that is about 62% of all exports from Africa come from just three countries. So Angola, the DRC, and South Africa. And South Africa is a major transshipment for lots of Southern African countries as well. And then 89% of exports from African countries to China is in extractives. And this is a relationship that in many ways looks like the European relationship of the past four or five centuries, that Africa is selling raw materials that are unfinished and unprocessed. And so, and then when we look at imports from China to Africa, again, highly distorted, that the bulk of Chinese imports tend to go to the largest countries, which makes sense, Nigeria, Egypt, Kenya. They are the largest, they have the biggest populations, but the Chinese engagement across Africa is not spread evenly. And I think that's also very important to have that texture in terms of how we understand it. I think in terms of, Alicia, the relationship between Europe and Africa, one has to appreciate how toxic this relationship is. And one of the reasons why there's so much enthusiasm to talk about the China narrative rather than the Europe relationship is because of this incredibly painful, violent, traumatic history that exists between these two. We cannot ignore that. And that is just the reality, is that still to this day, when we look at foreign investment in Africa, the bulk of it comes from the former colonial powers. And many of the institutions of colonialism are still very much in place. And what we see in places like the Sahel is this deep, deep animosity and frustration with France, for example. That has an historical context that too often when we discuss trade and economics is missing. So the reason why there is so much enthusiasm for China is because in very profound ways, it is an alternative. Is it a break from the past? China comes to Africa and says, those same jerks that colonized you colonized us. And you see this in their statements when she meets with various heads of state, that we have this shared colonial history with them. And I think that's a very important part of the story that is underappreciated in the West.
Yes, surely. But what about the U.S. then?
Same. There's a lot of trauma with the U.S.
But the U.S. did not colonize Africa. So I would argue that you're right, but it's also about old power versus new power. It's also about South with South versus North with North. I mean, yes, it's colonialism, but I think it's more than that. It's the idea of if China made it, why couldn't I make it as a Southern power? So I would say I fully agree with you, but in a way it gets more complex because China offers that example of, you know, a country that really made it and that is confronting, quote unquote, the West. And I think that's very valuable for any developing economy. I can fully understand that. Now, the question is, for how long will China look like a developing economy, or will China start looking like a new power, which is also extracting resources, blah, blah, blah. So where are we in that discourse?
I have a Twitter feed or an X feed of every Chinese embassy and diplomat in Africa. And it's a fascinating, you know, way to see into the way that the Chinese are framing their engagement in Africa. And Alicia, you're 100% correct when you say that they are demonstrating that in your and my lifetime, I'm 54, and in my lifetime, China has gone from a country that was poorer than most African countries to becoming today, they show pictures of Chongqing and they show pictures of the maglev in Shanghai and they say, today we are the second largest economy and we have this really high-tech future. And then they bring African stakeholders, journalists, scholars, politicians, all of these folks, bring them over to China and say, look, this happened in your lifetimes or in your parents' lifetimes. And what they're saying is that our model can be your inspiration. So, Alicia, you're 100% right. And they're going to hold on to this idea that they are a developing country forever, because it's part of their core DNA, that they do not see themselves as part of the OECD. They do not see themselves as part of the G7. They do not see themselves as part of the industrial West. And it doesn't look like there's any indication that they're ever going to do that. In many ways, they're going to be a little bit like Japan, where they want to modernize without westernizing. And that's a very important distinction, where we in the West oftentimes think of modernization as implicitly linked to westernization. Japan, South Korea, also China as well, do not make those connections and those links. Anybody that thinks South Korea and Japan are Western just hasn't spent any time there. China's going down that path. And I think that they want to show Africa and the global South that there is a path to modernize and to develop. And you look at that Twitter feed, and it's basically just a stream of infrastructure porn. You know, look at our subways, look at our buses, look at our EVs, look at everything that we've done. And here's the thing. For countries that lack infrastructure and lack good governance and lack those systems, that is inspiring. When the West comes and talks about civil rights and political rights and LGBTQ, all important issues, but they're not the pressing issues of the day for countries that are facing dire economic population growth, particularly in Africa, where the median age is 19.4 years old across the continent. In some countries like Nigeria, it's 17, 18 years old. So the idea of these abstract concepts of civil liberties, civil rights, governance, which is what we focus on in our engagement, compared to bread and butter economic issues that the Chinese come talking about, infrastructure and trade and technology. That's another reason why China's story in Africa resonates much more than it does with Europe and the U.S. And as for the U.S. did not colonize Africa, I think a lot of people in places like the DRC would strenuously disagree with that, given the fact that it was the United States that ushered in people like Mobutu Sese Seko and other dictators. So during the Cold War, we had a neo-colonial type of relationship in Africa, if it not was a formal relationship in terms of colonialism.
Eric, thanks for that. Just to add that then Russia also colonized Africa, and maybe it's colonizing Africa again. So don't get me started on this one.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
Yes, I'm already seeing the heat of the discussion coming. Still, it's nice to get an overview of the engagement and what kind of economic importance it has been for Africa and both for China. As you both rightly pointed out, that China is much more important to Africa. Going to the next section, where we want to talk about, while considerable economic benefits have been delivered to Africa, there has also been some challenges and criticism towards China's engagement in the continent. Eric, could you give us some examples of what main arguments have there been coming from African countries?
Well, so we have to distinguish between the criticisms of Chinese engagement in Africa that come largely from the West, talking about China as a neo-colonial, talking about debt trap diplomacy, talking about labor abuses and things like that, and those that come from African governments and civil society themselves, which are oftentimes very different. And so, for example, the debt trap argument predominantly is one that comes from India, the U.S., and Europe, and does not come from the African governments themselves. You've never heard an African president or prime minister on the record complaining about this. And the reason why is that when we look at the total amount of Chinese debt in Africa, it's about 18% at its peak. Now it's even down to about 12% of the total amount of debt. When we compare Chinese loans in Africa to Eurobond and private creditor loans, they're dwarfed by it, even those from the multilateral development banks as well. And we've seen debt restructurings now in Angola, in Ghana, in Ethiopia, and also in Zambia now that the Chinese have been participating in, though they have been problematic. The major problem with the Chinese lending in Africa is the opacity of the loans. And this has been something that has been a problem in many places. However, most African countries and civil society stakeholders are not as frustrated with the Chinese. They're frustrated with their own leaders who agree to these loans and violate their own constitutional laws on procurement transparency. And so the frustration that a lot of people have is the fact that they feel that the Chinese are in collusion with their leaders against the people's interests. This is what we saw in Kenya with the Standard Gauge Railway, where Kenyan law requires the publication of all procurement contracts. There was the High Court of Mombasa, heard the case from civil society stakeholders, said you must publish this contract. The Chinese put non-disclosure agreements in each of these contracts, and it's also very important to put this into context. Those non-disclosure agreements are standard in these types of lending contracts. China, by no means, is exceptional in how it does these loan contracts. And when you look at other types of loan contracts, NDAs are a standard part. I don't say this to excuse the Chinese in any way, just to say that they're less exceptional in many ways than many people think they are. And so I think that's really important to understand. So the concerns about the Chinese oftentimes come on issues of transparency. There are issues, for example, in the early parts of the Chinese engagement on labor. That's less of an issue now. The Chinese don't bring much labor into Africa as they once did in the early 2000s, but there's still a perception that they do. There's also issues that in certain civil society sectors about environmental destruction due to mining in places like the DRC. And these are all legitimate concerns. Illegal mining, for example, in Ghana is also another major concern that you hear from civil society. This is a very, very complex relationship. And also one has to distinguish between the Chinese government, which is, for example, on the lending side, which comes from policy banks, and the illegal mining, which happens from independent Chinese migrants have nothing to do with the government. So there's a wide range of Chinese actors in Africa. So it's a little bit dangerous sometimes to say China or Chinese, because it is a very diverse contingent of people who are there.
Thank you for that, Eric. And I see you have read my questions, because I was going to ask Alicia on what arguments and criticism have the West been delivering when it comes to China's engagement in Africa. So maybe, Alicia, you can start from there.
Yeah. I would like to say the following, that I hear you, Eric, that nobody's perfect. Certainly the West isn't in its relations with Africa. So we can't really offer many lessons as to what China is doing. So that's a given. But having said that, I think there are issues which relate to the rules of the game. Let's call them the rules of the game. So, you know, we have institutions, whether it's the Paris Club. We may not like these institutions. We may want to change these institutions. But the point is, while we change them, I would argue that the rules that have been there to deal with debt restructuring, which, by the way, have been improved over time. We have had, you know, new initiatives to make debt restructuring easier, to which, I mean, the different constituencies of the IMF have agreed, including China for that matter, that are not being observed. And the word is observed in the sense that China, being a major creditor, is still just an observer at the Paris Club. And this means that, yes, nobody's perfect, but I think there is this attempt to basically play as a small player while being a huge player. And a small player means that you can basically free ride because you are not being seen. I think there is about time for China to realize that that's not something that can continue.
But to be fair here, the Paris Club is not being marginalized because of China. It's being marginalized because the amount of private bondholder debt is far larger than bilateral debt that used to come from Paris Club members. China is never going to join the Paris Club because it will never agree to the transparency requirements that the Paris Club obligates. But at the same time, again, that we see, and this is some of the discussions I'm having with multilateral development banks here in Washington, that they too have been privately saying that the Paris Club is being relegated to the sidelines by virtue of the scale of all the different lenders who are in there. So it's not just the sovereigns, which is what it, Paris Club, it was born in an era when it was countries in the West, in the global North, giving money to poorer countries in the global South.
I don't agree with
that
this.
That was a month.
Because this happened a long time ago, Eric. This happened in 2000
right.
with the Argentine sovereign crisis, and China wasn't
today,
even there.
It's nowhere comparable to what it was in Argentina. We're talking about the scale of bondholder debt is enormous. But also, remember, we've got private banks who are much larger and much more engaged. In terms of the Chinese, we have a lot of actors beyond the policy banks. We've got state-owned enterprises. We've got semi-private banks like ICBC. All of these different actors, the landscape is just way more complex than just the Paris Club.
I would disagree, fully disagree. I actually think that the Argentine sovereign crisis in 2000 was much more privately owned than Zambia, for that matter, by all means. So no, I don't think the Paris Club is irrelevant because of the role of the private sector. In fact, the whole point of the Paris Club is not to restructure all of the debt. It has never been. I mean, in Argentina, the Paris Club only restructured the public part of the debt. And the role of the IMF is to broker, basically, a restructuring that engages the private sector, whether it's with CACs, whether it's, you know, at the time it was, the discussion was SDRM. I mean, different strategies to involve the private sector with the public sector. But within the public sector, and bear in mind that China has managed to exclude from that public sector even China's development bank, for that matter, only Exim Bank is considered state-owned.
That's right, because CDB runs commercial debt, which
well,
is almost
this,
like a private bank.
This is not what I consider the CDB to do, having actually observed a lot of what they lend. But I actually realized that CDB has a different legal status from Exim Bank in China. So, you know, accepting China's legislation, I'm nobody to judge whether this is right or not. But the nature of the lending is very similar. But having said that, I think the whole point accepting China's definition of what is public versus private, excluding SOEs, excluding state-owned commercial banks, excluding CDB, whatever is left, is already big enough for China to play a role, in my opinion. If not the Paris Club, a new club. But the idea of playing in the game, for me, is very disturbing.
I don't disagree with you that they're not playing in the game and that they want to change the rules because they don't feel that the rules are in their interest or their benefit.
Yeah.
But just so I understand what you're saying, do you believe that the debt crisis that we have now in a growing number of developing countries in Africa, the Middle, in Asia and elsewhere, Laos, for example, is because of China and the Paris Club, or is it bigger than that?
I'm not saying it's because of China. Look at Sri Lanka. China is 10%. I'm of course not saying it's because of China. I'm saying that the very few mechanisms we have to try to help, which were used in the past, even when private debt was humongous, like Argentina, where, by the way, we had the Japanese as major private debt holders, and you know, it was widespread among many, many countries. I frankly think that the ability to renegotiate debt today is less, not because of China only, but because of US-China strategic competition. You see, it's about a change in the time. And because China is not part or willing to be part of the very few institutions that we have to do that, that makes things more complicated. China has its own right not to want to be part of this. I understand that, but maybe we should have a conversation what kind of other institutions we need. Because of US-China strategic competition, this is not happening. So I'm not blaming China. I'm just saying that unfortunately for Africa, we are here. And what we did with Ecuador, what we did with Argentina is no longer possible.
Now, let's not forget that the Chinese did come to the IMF during the Obama administration and asked for an increase of their share in the IMF commensurate with the size of their economy. And the Obama administration refused to exceed that. So the idea that, and I'm not defending the Chinese, please, I don't want to be perceived that way, but I do want to say that the Western institutions are not exactly welcoming of engagement with the Chinese.
Yes.
And that does create problems in terms of saying, well, they're not playing nicely with the Western institutions. And now with the debt trap narratives largely coming from people at the Treasury Department and Ursula von der Leyen herself, if you were the Chinese policymaking community, you'd think, why would I want to get involved with these guys if they're only going to slap me at every turn? Because you know full well that if the Chinese opened up all of their lending contracts, which is something, by the way, that the French and Germans don't do either. Find me a German development loan contract that's easily accessible on the web. And scholars here that I've spoken to have had a very difficult time getting access to European concessional lending documents too. So this secrecy thing is not uniquely a Chinese issue.
I'm sorry, Eric. I've been trying to get China Development Bank data, just the total amount of overseas loans per region. I'm talking about the numbers, not the contracts. Even that is not available.
It's unbelievably difficult. They are so opaque, and it serves them so poorly to do that.
Yeah.
But through aid data, we do know what the contracts look like. They have hundreds of contracts now online at Aid Data's website.
But Aid Data is not official data.
This is the problem. But we see the official contracts. We do see the official contracts.
Yes, but what I'm saying is researchers need to actually come up with estimates of the amount of lending per region just because we don't even have the total lending.
100%.
Totally
agree.
Whether contracts are equally opaque, I have nothing to say. Probably you're right. I've never looked at any of those contracts in detail. But what I'm trying to say here is comparing the level of opacity by comparing whether we know the contracts when we don't even have the numbers, official numbers, is not something I would accept.
Yeah, no, you and I don't have any disagreement there that the Chinese really undermine their status in this when they are so difficult to deal with on this. I couldn't agree more on that.
Maybe a quick add here is that since now the macroeconomic data from China is so hard to get access, here at Bruegel, we actually have a China economic database that we update regularly, for the most relevant macroeconomic data for China and EU-China relations.
Yes, but we need Eric for Africa. We have no section on Africa and China. Yeah. Well, I'm sure Eric can help.
No, we could, but I'll point your listeners to people like Deborah Browdigim and Yushan Huang and Yufang Wang and some others who have done some great work on this. And there's a lot of fantastic research being done in the research community about Chinese debt and Chinese debt levels. So, So we do quite a bit ourselves here at CGSP, too.
Thank you very much for providing the resources. And I'm also quite enjoying this conversation where the both of you demonstrate the different perspective here. Although, Eric, you said you don't want to be portrayed as the Chinese.
No, not at all. But just sometimes pushing back and not on what Alicia is saying, but sometimes on the very reductive Western narratives that often kind of flatten out this very complex relationship. And so, for example, when we look at Sri Lanka, Zambia, and Ghana, they did not enter into default or run into the problems that they ran into because of Chinese loans. They were up against Eurobond payments that they couldn't make. And yet the way that is presented is that it's Chinese debt that caused the problems in these countries. And again, that is an oversimplification of what is a very complicated issue.
Thank you very much for adding to that. Actually, you already started. My next question is that, are there concerns very different coming from the West or coming from African countries when it comes to like China's engagement in Africa? I think, Eric, you made it pretty clear. And I want to ask Alicia if you want to add any points from here.
Let me make a bigger point here. I mean, here's the thing. China is the South. Africa is the South. China surely understands Africa well. There's been, you know, long history since the CCP came to power, for that matter, of political relations. So there you go. You should see benefits. I mean, it's like, you know, you should see big benefits. What could be the one I would imagine we should be seeing? And it's been a while already, and unfortunately, we're not yet seeing it. But it would be manufacturing into Africa for a growing population, huge market, manufacturing into Africa to serve that continent. Europe missed that boat, and Eric, you gave us a very good reason where we used to be colonialist in this region, so very hard for Europe to do that. Why isn't China doing this? Why That's isn't China thinking of that continent as a manufacturing platform for itself? That's my question.
Oh, there's a pretty simple answer: because of cost. Unfortunately, there's an infrastructure deficit in Africa that pushes up the cost of manufacturing. Supply chains don't come into Africa to provide the inputs for manufacturing. And so the cost of manufacturing in Southeast Asia or China or Bangladesh and then exporting to Africa is vastly cheaper than it is to set up factories that have unreliable power supplies, that oftentimes have governance issues, that don't have road rail infrastructures. And so Chinese investors have looked at that and said, it doesn't really make a lot of sense. Now, that excludes some of the MENA markets. So, for example, Morocco is doing incredible auto manufacturing. South Africa is industrialized. But for the rest of the continent, it's not just China. Industrialization has been a huge problem, largely because of infrastructure. We're looking at infrastructure deficits, you know, in the hundreds of billions of dollars every year, trillions over the decades that to come. That is the main reason why it's difficult for the Chinese to justify setting up large-scale manufacturing operations in one of the poorest, least developed parts of the world.
That Africa won't develop sustainably because it can't afford
to. That's not China's fault, though.
Of course not. But the point is, there is a claim here from China that it's helping develop Africa. And my question is, can this be done without manufacturing? Because, frankly speaking, Africa cannot afford
infrastructure.
Trade deficits
and China
forever.
Says, we're building infrastructure.
Yeah.
So manufacturing requires infrastructure. And China, and there's no way to deny that China's contributions to Africa's infrastructure portfolio has been enormous. I mean, just go to Nairobi and you can
yes.
see the expressway.
But
you can
is
see
it the right infrastructure?
Railway,
is
the
it
Jomo
the right?
Kenyatta.
But the question on the right infrastructure is driven by the host country. It's not driven by the Chinese. These are decisions made by the host governments. So whether they want, so it's not China coming and saying, I'm going to put a railroad in the middle of Botswana. It's up to Botswana. It is up to South Africa. It's up to all of the different countries to engage China to say, this is the project we want. Here's the feasibility study. This is the financing we need. But this is not a top-down issue from the Chinese to African countries.
Then it works very differently in Africa than elsewhere. Well, think about the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor. That was basically a Chinese decision.
Yeah, no, in that case, it is different. Oh, no, absolutely is different. But in this particular case, and we have the FOCAC summit coming up in September 3rd to the 8th, and what the preparations for the FOCAC, which is the Forum on China-Africa Cooperation Summit, it happens every 3 years, and what the preparations for this are is African governments to rally together to put their feasibility studies in there, and they pitch for Chinese investment and Chinese financing. So this is very much demand-driven. So again, the Chinese are not coming in top-down and saying, we're going to put the railway in Ethiopia. Because at the end of the day, these are loans that the Ethiopians and the Djiboutians took out. They are obligated to repay these loans, but it's not because they were forced to do so with a gun to the back of their head.
Thank you both for the very interesting discussion, although we can continue this conversation for days because Africa is not just one continent, but each country is very different, and we're here just to provide first general analysis. Before I close the session, may I just have each of you to have a closing note and for the outlook. Maybe I'll give the floor to Eric first.
The fundamental challenge that the U.S. and Europe have in their engagement in Africa is, what's the offer on the table? What are they bringing? You know, the main thrust in Europe today is to make sure that the people from Africa stay on their side of the Mediterranean. Immigration is the big issue. It's not a very welcoming continent in many respects towards Africans, and the attitudes you see coming out of Germany and France and elsewhere in Italy and Spain is one of general hostility. The United States, we're about to embark potentially on another Trump administration, and the Muslim bans that were in place in the first Trump administration are probably going to come back. And when you talk to American stakeholders, the government, civil society and others, and you say, what are you offering African governments when you sit down and talk with them? And the problem is there isn't a very clear focus. And usually what comes up is a little bit like what Alicia was talking about, is this rules-based international order. But the rules-based international order in many ways is backwards looking. We want to preserve the rules the way they were. And those rules really did not benefit people at the bottom of the pyramid, particularly those who had to endure proxy wars during the Cold War. And so when you talk to Africans and they say, what do the Chinese come with? And they're coming oftentimes, it flawed as it may be, and I'm not endorsing it, but listen to what they're coming with. Belt and Road, the BRICS, the AIIB, the New Development Bank, FOCAC that happens every 3 years. Every 2 years, there's a China-Africa Economic Trade Expo in Changsha. More African students are going to China to study than any other country in the world except France, and they're about to surpass France. These are all forward-looking visions. They're bringing technology. Huawei, for example, has wired up the vast majority of the continent. Transsion is a Chinese phone company, is by far the dominant mobile device. It's Chinese apps like Boomplay, StarTimes that are dominating in media. These are forward-looking initiatives. And that is the challenge that the West has when they talk to Africa, is what is the offer on the table? And for a continent that in many ways is starved of a future, that is isolated in many respects, try to get a visa from Nigeria and come to the United States, and it's impossible. Try to get a visa from Nigeria going to China, and it's much easier. So for a future starved continent of teenagers, China at least brings some vision of a future that is positive. It may just be propaganda, and it may just be infrastructure porn on Twitter, as we saw, but at least it's something that's forward-looking and not backwards-looking.
Alicia, the floor is yours.
Well, I do think Eric has a point in terms of the West having missed an opportunity, several opportunities to engage with Africa. Certainly, things could have worked better had we had a better migration policy. But the reality is that China doesn't have any. So comparing the two on migration won't be favorable to China. On other instances, as, for example, Chinese migration towards Africa, private sector, restaurants, you name it, that's clearly engaging, but this is not necessarily only Africa. I mean, it's clearly the case of Europe or the US, where actually Chinese are now the largest migrant population, even more than Mexican at this juncture. But it would be unfair to compare Europe with China because it's a question of income per capita and the dire situation in which the Chinese economy is today, which forces that migration in search for opportunities. Opportunities that sometimes Africans feel are being taken away from them by, for that matter. So it is a complex issue. China does engage with Africa. Europe has a harder time because of colonialism. So does the hegemon, the US. But that doesn't mean that China's engagement is perfect. In fact, FDI, lending, all of these flows that used to be abundant are now at a minimum from China and still very much below those Western countries that Africa seems not too willing to engage with because of colonialism. But at the end of the day, those are the largest flows, the largest trade surplus for Africa and the biggest foreign direct investment into Africa. So realities versus narratives do look very different in the continent. China is winning the narrative, but it might not necessarily be the winner as far as Africa is concerned in terms of economic opportunities.
I am Yu Yunzhan, and I am with Alicia Garcia Herrero, senior fellow here at Bruegel, and Eric Olander, veteran journalist and the co-founder of the China Global South Project. For listeners, you can find all our research on China at Bruegel.org and sign up for our China podcast and newsletter with link in the show notes. Until next time, bye-bye.